September 23, 1831. My dear Phillips, I'm busy just now again on electromagnetism and think I have got hold of a good thing, but can't say. It may be a weed instead of a fish that after all my labor I may at last pull up. It wasn't a weed, and after a few more days' work he had the decisive result. By October, he was able to present it in an immensely simple form. He merely held a child's small bar magnet in one hand and a coiled wire in the other. He pushed the magnet toward the coil of wire, and an electric current started up in the wire. He held the magnet still, the current stopped. He moved the magnet again, the current started up again. So long as he moved the magnet in the vicinity of the wire, he created an electric current. No one ever had understood this before. He'd created a force field. Something was traveling from the magnet into the wire. But that couldn't happen if the space between them was empty. There, in his cool basement laboratory at the Royal Institute, with the horse-drawn traffic of Regency London pounding outside, Faraday had shown that electricity wasn't some hissing liquid that could only be funneled along inside a wire. Rather, it could be brought into existence by an invisible force that spread from a moving magnet and stretched across empty space. Faraday had opened the door to something greater than anyone had imagined. If he was right, then whenever his nieces playfully tugged a toy magnet, they were also tugging an invisible force field that spread out from the metal of that moving magnet. As best Faraday could estimate, the force field stretched on forever. If he and his nieces were inside a building, part of the force field would stretch outward through an open window or perhaps even through the wall, absolutely invisible, and continue to the moon or possibly beyond. It got stranger. Faraday's basement experiment suggested that our world was filled with untold millions of these invisible flying force fields. There were hundreds of ships in the London ports and thousands of carriages on the London streets, and whenever any mariner or coachman's magnetic compass needle moved, yet more of these invisible force fields would be loosed. When Faraday looked out at Regency London, the sky wasn't empty above him. It was arcing with these powerful, invisible presences. The Book of Nature, which we have to read, he'd once written, is written by the finger of God. He was right, and now he had shown that God was a flamboyant, hallucinatory titan, blasting his universe with hitherto unseen, vivid streaks. Faraday's insights are at the heart of modern technology, and even, as we'll see, would eventually answer the question about why electrons don't pile up at the end of a long phone line. But although he now held a distinguished position at the Royal Institution, he hadn't outlived his past. Most of his English colleagues believed that he was only a clever tinkerer. They knew about his embarrassing lack of formal education. They'd seen that he couldn't express his insights in the advanced mathematics they so easily used. To all but a few of them, his excited theories of invisible force fields seemed entirely unfounded, and so his ideas were politely set aside. Faraday made many more discoveries. He had audiences with prime ministers. He became greatly respected for his popular lectures. At one point, a brilliant young woman became fascinated by what his electricity findings might suggest for her own research. This is one of the great might-have-beens of history, for the woman was the late Lord Byron's daughter, Ada, Countess of Lovelace, and she'd been working on early notions of what we now call computer programming. No technology of the time could entirely build what she envisaged, but who knows what Faraday might have come up with. He seemed entranced by her, but soon stepped back, probably to avoid jeopardizing his own marriage. He didn't give up, though. When he'd been criticized for his religion, he had turned to the Bible for consolation. Now, criticized by the great majority of researchers for his idea about force fields, he turned back to Isaac Newton. Although Newton was said to have had a different view about empty space, maybe that wasn't quite true. Newton was the greatest thinker science had ever produced. Even a hint in his writings that Faraday might be right would be comforting. On the surface, it would seem impossible, but in fact, Newton had once revealed doubts about his public vision in a brief, relaxed moment in his old age. To an inquisitive young Cambridge theologian, Richard Bentley, Newton wrote in 1693 that perhaps the universe wasn't so empty. Perhaps, on the contrary, there really were forces, such as gravity, that sent out tendrils crisscrossing what seemed like empty space. The idea that one body may act upon another at a distance through a vacuum without the mediation of anything else, Newton daringly wrote, is to me so great an absurdity that I believe no man who has any competent faculty of thinking can ever fall into it. Now, more than 140 years later, as Faraday was hunting for confirmation that he hadn't been entirely wrong, he found Newton's very old letter to Bentley. With that, Faraday realized he wasn't alone. Newton had been there before. Beyond that, Faraday couldn't go. In old age, his memory already fading, he wrote to a young friend, the gifted Scottish physicist James Clerk Maxwell. Royal Institution, November 13, 1857. My dear sir, there is one thing I would be glad to ask you. When a mathematician engaged in investigating physical actions and results has arrived at his own conclusions, may they not be expressed in common language as fully, clearly, and definitely as in mathematical formulae? If so, would it not be a great boon to such as we to express them so, translating them out of their hieroglyphics, that we almost might work upon them by experiment? Maxwell wrote back diligently, but Faraday remained left behind. His weakness in mathematics had helped him start a major inquiry, but he was never going to be able to lead its further development in his lifetime. Still, Faraday consoled himself by taking a long view. He was convinced that someday there would be practical inventions that depended on what he'd seen. When that finally occurred, even the critics who dismissed him would have to accept that his hunches were true. What he didn't realize, as the decades went on and he was reaching 60, was that he would live long enough to see it happen. A giant engineering adventure was soon to take place deep under the sea. When it was completed, there would be tantalizing further evidence that everything he'd imagined about invisible force fields really was true.